The Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio is on the air.
Hello.
Hello, this is Lanval from Edenbridge. Hello.
Hey, how are you doing, Lanval?
I'm fine, thanks. And you?
Good. So how's the weather over there in Austria?
Beautiful. Really like spring-like. We had a lot of snow in the last couple of days, but the spring weather was melting it away, so.
Ah, beautiful. Yeah, we're obviously going through a lot of snow days ourselves, but right now we still got a little bit on the ground, but it's pretty nice. I mean, it's definitely warmed up. We were having a cold snap, so.
So you're on the East Coast, or?
Yeah, I'm over in New York. Yeah.
All right, okay.
All right, so I guess if you're ready, we can get rolling.
Yeah, we can.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema, your source for in-depth discussion of cult cinema and music. Tonight, none other than the guitarist and musical mastermind behind symphonic metal veterans Edenbridge, the incomparable Lanval, on the Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio. Cinema, your source for music and film that matter. Cult, underground, independent, and generally falling outside the mainstream corporate boardroom paint-by-numbers bullshit. Tonight we speak with a man whose unusually uplifting and musically engaging style and approach I've been a fan of for many years. With their particularly positive, even spiritual approach to metal, incorporating a non-standard uses of two-handed guitar, a strong background in classical composition, and perhaps an unconscionable number of key change modulations per song, he and longtime partner and vocalist, the lovely Sabina Adelsbacher, have built themselves their own special niche, more unlike any of their ostensible peers than most bands can truly lay claim to in today's often overcrowded market. With us to talk the recent remasters and reissues of the original five Edenbridge albums, as well as their new side project, Boisiano, join us as we speak with a truly unique force in the metal scene, the one and only Lanval. But first, just to give you an idea of what we're talking about, here's one off the very first Edenbridge album. This is the title cut to Sunrise in Eden.
Hi, this is Udo Dockstader, singer of UDO, and you listen to the show Third Eye Cinema.
Greetings, pathetic mortal scum. This is Chris from Gloriana, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
That's my evil wizard.
Wow, that was great. Can you do one in the pirate voice?
Sure, I could be Captain Chris from Aelstrom if you want that.
Sure.
God, that's all I do is put on fucking accents all day long. Ahoy there, shipmates. This is Chris from Aelstrom, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema. Yar.
Well,
I hate myself.
No, that was great. I can't tell you how much I appreciate that.
Tonight, we're talking metal, and we have with us a man whose name is practically synonymous with symphonic metal. With his lush, multi-instrumental, and compositional approach, his band has been something of a breath of fresh air amidst a scene too often marked by a focus on darkness and despair. With a restless, searching musicality to his harmonic structure and a classically influenced yet two-handed approach to the guitar, he touches on elements of metal, classical, and jazz without ever being truly defined by any of them. Together with the lovely Sabina Edelsbacher, whose dulcet tones have graced his material from the earliest days of their band, they've produced 8 quite often essential and unique studio albums, 2 live albums, and a plethora of singles and rarities over the 15 years they've been together. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome a truly major player in the European metal scene and an impressive player in his own right, guitarist, producer, and bandleader, Arne Stockhammer, better known to the listening audience as Eden Bridges' incomparable, Lon Vall. Lon Vall, welcome to Third Eye Cinema.
Hello.
So, given your recent remastering of much of the Eden Bridge back catalog, which we'll touch on in a bit, let's take this back to the beginning. You came onto the scene during what, at least for audiences here in the States, was something of an odd time for metal, back in 99, 2000. It was probably the lowest point of popularity for this sort of music, coming after grunge, drum and bass, and industrial. I believe we were still in the middle of the new metal aggro thing at the time, which is something very different from what you're doing. So what inspired you to put out the sort of music that you did during that time?
Well, Eden Bridge was always a band, and myself, I always tried to make the music that comes out of my heart. So I've never faced any trends and music that is hip at the moment, because I think you can only survive on the long run if you're really doing what you love. And in the 90s, it was not only in America that metal had a hard time, also in Europe. But I think around 96, 97, metal became popular again. And in our case, of course, it was the female-fronted metal, and we were among the first, one of the first bands that established this style in establishing a female singer. And of course, we were at the right time, at the right place back in 98, 99. And I think that was a good time to come into the scene. And I mean, I've been working together with female singers since 1994. Sabina joined the pre-band of Eden Bridge in 96. So yeah, at that time, nobody ever spoke of so-called female-fronted metal.
Now, I'm going to start walking through the back catalog a bit, and we'll address more broad-based matters as they come up along the way. Most bands don't come onto the scene fully formed, but from the first notes of Cheyenne Spirit that opened Sunrise in Eden, the classic Eden Bridge sounds all there. You can almost hear the dawning strains of the grand design at the first drop of the needle. So how did you manage to define a sound and template to that extent coming right out of the gate?
Well, I think it was a kind of development, of course. I mean, I've been writing songs for so many years, and as you might know, I had a solo project in the 90s. I did 3 solo albums, and besides that, I also wrote metal, of course. And, well, the sound, of course, changed and developed a lot in the past 15 years, I would say.
Yeah.
Because, of course, I can still stand behind all our outputs, of course, but when you listen to our first album and then compare it to the new one, I think you will really recognize the big development the band was going through. But, yeah, anyway, I mean, I can really say that with every album we gave our best at that time, and I think this is important. And how could I sit here and say we didn't make any development in those years? I mean, this would be a disappointment, of course, because a band that doesn't develop is somehow strange, in my opinion, because you're not the same person anymore that you have been 15 years ago, and you're growing as a musician, you're growing as a human being, and I think this is reflecting in the music, and if that doesn't reflect, then you're on a standstill.
No, that wasn't my point at all. What I was trying to say is that you could hear the clear progression to where you were going to go right from the beginning. It wasn't like some bands come in and they're very raw, and then they develop over
over time into something completely different. You kind of had a clear vision for where at least the first part of your career was going, right up through the Grand Design.
Yeah, pretty much it is like this. Of course, I have to say that maybe some albums have quite a similar backing, like Arcana and Aphelion, which are somehow in one mood, maybe because the time in between was very short. But nevertheless, I would see ourselves as going through three different phases. So I would say the first phase was from Sunrise in Eden to Aphelion. And then there was a real change between Aphelion and Shine. Shine was a very,
right,
very diverse and very different album than Aphelion was. And I think Grand Design could be seen also in this mood of Shine. And then there was the third step,
right,
starting from My Off Dream, where we changed a lot, becoming more and more orchestral, changed the tuning of the guitars, integrated seven-string guitars. So I would say this is the third step in the band Edenbridge, from My Off Dream to the bonding. And let's see where the journey will continue in the future.
Exactly. And we'll get to some of the stuff as we go along. So back at the beginning with Sunrise in Eden, how did you get those sort of Kodo sounds that kick off the title track, Sunrise in Eden? I'm assuming they were simulated via guitar and effects rig from the tone.
It's just synth sounds. It isn't a real Kodo.
Right.
Because back at that time, we worked a lot with samples. I mean, we had some real instruments like the sitar and things like that. But it's a sample sound from the old Kurzweil K2000, what I remember.
So two things immediately mark off the classic Edinburgh sound. Above and beyond Sabina's sweet and tender, yet assertive and short soprano, and your serif-smooth two-handed guitar technique, there's a dreaminess, a gentleness, and positivity to your approach that you just don't find in metal anywhere else, even in the symphonic or arguably gothic or power metal genres Edinburgh more or less touches upon or inhabits. So where does this basic core sentiment spring from? Because it's quite unusual for the genre and the styles that you've been associated with.
Yeah, hard to say. I mean, this is, as I said before, it's simply the music that comes out of myself. And when I learned guitar, I mean, I've been growing up as a piano player, started playing piano when I was 7. So this was the basis of my musical development. And the guitar started later on. But when I started playing guitar, I always wanted to develop my own style and not listening. Of course, I listened to other players, but I didn't want to copy anybody. And I think therefore especially my solo sound become quite unique in the kind of tremolo I have, in the kind of tone I have. And so this is, I think we found each other. I mean, I found the perfect singer with Sabina. And yeah, it's great to look back on this big musical career in the past 15 years, and I see no end in that. So it will be interesting where the journey will continue, also with our new project Voiciana, which we have started last year.
Right. And secondly, the Edinburgh sound has always been marked by an ever-climbing or ascending feel, where not only solos, but the songs themselves seem to remain more or less unresolved, but never like circling aimlessly like streams more than words, where it just keeps going around and around. You keep modulating through related keys, but markedly upwards every time. And there's this strong feel of, I don't know, climbing up to the heavens or something that I have to assume is deliberate, given the band name. What was the genesis of this approach?
Yeah, it's great that you have recognized this. I mean, often these journalists, which maybe are not so interested in music theory, don't discover that. But the modulation is one of an essential thing in songwriting, I think, because it keeps the music interesting. And I love juggling through the different keys and different tonalities, and also integrating some unusual chords, of course, into our music. When you listen to the end part of the Grand Design, you use a lot of those swing chords, like seven flat,
right,
five chords, and then things like that, six chords. I love those chords, because they are bringing, they are not usual for metal, and
right,
everything that is not usual for metal is great to integrate.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm a guitarist myself, and I tend to come from a little bit of a jazzy, bluesy background, so as well
All right.
as metal, obviously. So I know exactly what you're talking about. But even beyond that, with a jazz kind of a thing, you've got this thing where you're pointedly going upwards every time. You're always resolving upwards through various keys. So was that deliberate, given Edinbridge? You know, you're searching for Eden, you're going for the heavens, or was this just an accidental thing?
I think this is purely accidental to building the things upwards. But I would say, I mean, my classical background is simply the basis of composing and also of modulating and going through the different keys, because in romantic symphonies, you also find constant key changes. And I think this is simply the basis, and simply the basis of theory behind everything.
Right, and I actually recall it being slightly off-putting at the first listen in that here you have such a smooth and melodic sound, and yet there's this unrelenting restlessness underpinning the whole affair. You know, it's like you're never content to sit there and work out on a given vamp or a relative minor. You have to work your way through multiple key changes and modulations over the course of a single given song. So given that, do you feel that Edenbridge can also be considered progressive act in the sense of bands like Fates Warning, Queensrÿche, or Crimson Glory, who you'd otherwise have no real ties to musically?
Well, I love all of those three bands you mentioned, of course. I mean, Fates Warning was my absolute favorite band in the 80s. I love Queensrÿche till the Promised Land album. Everything that coming after was purely pure shit.
I agree.
And Crimson Glory, Transcendence, is one of my favorite albums of all times, of course. So I think, yeah, I would consider Edenbridge to be a progressive band, but not in the sense of complexity, more in the sense of the sounds we're using and the keys we're using, and not in terms of odd rhythms and odd signatures and things like that. So progressive for me means that you go forward. You always go forward and doing the next thing and develop yourself. This is progressive in the pure sense, I would say. So I think this, if you mean this with progressive, then I think we're a progressive band, definitely.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to get at, because it does have a challenging aspect to the music that may appeal more to musicians than the general populace, who can get thrown by this continual melodic and harmonic motion. And yet you've got that sweetness overlaying it that gives it a broader appeal. So
Definitely, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what's also interesting is that, like we touched on earlier, right out of the gate, you deliver such a solid mission statement of what's to come. I mean, the first four tracks alone make the album, with Forever Shine On and Holy Fire closing the deal. And you'd still be giving nods to most or all these tracks by the time of Lifetime in Eden and the rather comprehensive Chronicles of Eden set years on. So obviously it's not like something you said, okay, this is my early stuff, I'm not going to touch it. You kept going back to these and saying, okay, here, I'm proud of this.
Yeah, definitely. What I said before, I mean, I'm standing still behind every album, and it was really funny because all of the first five albums were re-released last year, and I wrote all liner notes, of course. And so I listened to the songs back, and it was funny to listen back again, because normally I don't listen to my own music, because when I finish an album, it's done, and then I move forward to the next thing. But I have to admit, of course, that the band changed a lot from the first album, and therefore we also made a cut when it comes to the live set. So the oldest song we will have in our live set is the song Shine. And because we focus on the newer stuff, of course, now in the live scene, but that doesn't mean that I don't still stand behind the old stuff, of course.
Arcana introduced slight changes in that it was a bit more aggressive, with Starlight Reverie, Color My Sky, and Suspiria in particular being a little more intense and metalized than anything on Sunrise in Eden, without being too far of a stretch from the initial template. So how much of this do you think was due to the addition of Andreas Eibler on second guitar?
Well, he didn't have any effect on the songwriting, because the whole songwriting was in my hands.
Okay.
And I think it was more the process that the first album we signed the deal in 1999, end of 1999, and it was released in 2000 in autumn. So this pretty gave me a lot of time to focus on the second album when the first album even was finished. So I had a lot of time to write the stuff, and of course I had completely new inspiration. Of course, I mean, you could clearly recognize the band, but a lot of new stuff came in.
Right.
And when we had a second guitar player in the band, also focused more on double solos, of course.
Right.
And I think this was the reason why Arcana and also the following album, Aphelion, had a lot of double solo stuff back at that time.
Into the Light was a bit different. You know, there were certainly strong elements of the more traditional power ballad and an almost neoclassical feel to the solo, and yet it was marked by what would become your trademark, a prominent use of two-hand tapping work. So do you prefer working in that milieu over the more standard, you know, picking and legato method?
Well, I think Into the Light is an interesting song because it has a lot of different moods, and there is a tempo change in the end.
Right.
Sorry, what was the question again?
Well, I was trying to get at the fact that you really started to come into what's like your trademark of the two-hand work on the guitar.
Yeah.
And do you find that there's any benefits to working in that milieu as opposed to the more standard picking and legato playing that most people do?
Well, I always loved the two-hand tapping. It was always something interesting for me because you could create stuff that you cannot create with alternate picking or sweep picking or things like that. Therefore, I integrated it in my style very early, this whole tapping technique. But in the last albums, I got a bit away of it. Last albums, I first of all really focused on trying to create unique melodies on the guitar and of course, integrate my technique, but more focusing on the tone.
Right.
But still it is interesting, of course, the whole tapping thing.
Since you don't appear to be going for like a flashy Eddie Van Halen or even a Stanley Jordan kind of a show-off thing, but a more subtle and flowing approach to two-hand work, what advantages do you find playing in that style bring to a given piece or the overall Edinburgh sound?
Hard to say. I cannot really say. I mean, it's just the tapping technique is so much in me,
yeah.
and was so much in my playing before even Edenbridge was founded, that it's hard to, it was a completely natural thing to integrate it to the solo style and to the whole style of my solo thing. So it's really hard to say.
So what sort of post-amplifier processing do you use to get such a clear, fluid tone on what's basically a tapped approach?
Oh, I used different kind of things on all albums. I think, in my opinion, the tone comes out of your hands and your heart and not so much out of the amplifier. Of course, good amplifiers help, but I used the various things from the Digitech 2120 on the first album. Then I used some Meta Boogie stuff on Arcana and Aphelion. And my setup in the last years is the Marshall JMP, which is really a great amplifier, and this really gives me the soul and also the rhythm tone. So, but it's various things live and in the studio.
And are you using effects or amp heads afterwards, or is it just straight amplifier tone?
Well, my live setup is pretty simple. Because I'm still a fan of 19-inch amplifiers and effects, because my whole setup is switched by MIDI. Which
right.
is great because you don't have to focus on your foot
right.
switching the sounds. And anyway, the fact that we have to work with samples because the whole orchestra cannot be produced live, of course.
Right.
Then I can also let my sounds switch by MIDI, which is great. I play the Marshall. I play my Ibanez guitars. I play the Marshall JMP. I have the Digitech effect section, which is connected, and then I use a Mesa Boogie power amp and a Mesa Boogie cabinet. So this is pretty much my setup life. And in the studio, I use effects from the Pro Tools, delays and reverbs and everything.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema with a special guest tonight, Lon Ball from Edenbridge. Coming up next, we're talking influences, James Bond, Aphelion, Shine, and Grand Design. And you're on Third Eye Cinema. Stay tuned.
From Rhapsody of Fire, and you are listening to Third Eye Cinema. Enjoy!
Hi, this is Angelica Rillen for Third Eye Cinema. Rock on!
Hi, this is DC Cooper, and you are listening... Oops. Hi, this is DC Cooper from Royal Hunt, and you are listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Hi, everybody out there. This is Mike Kiska speaking, singing for Unisonic in Plasma Dome, and you are listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Hey, this is Zeep from the band Orden Ogan, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Next up, we'll be talking influences, James Bond, Aphelion, Shine, and the Grand Design. But first, continuing our walk through the Edenbridge musical timeline, here's one off Arcana. This is Color My Sky. We'll be right back. Now, I noticed on Suspiria that you were pulling the rhythm guitar chordal motion into some fairly outside tonal centers, particularly around the, you know, illusions can deceive, we're dying when you leave sections of the chorus. So what were you stretching for there? Were you actually going for like a jazz modality or?
Oh, you ask me questions. I cannot even remember which chords it was now. I should have a look in my line sheets to answer this question. Well, I know what you mean, of course. Well, this is hard to say. I mean, it's all trying to find new things, juggling around with different harmonies and things like that. So it's a very natural thing, nothing that I really, really think of.
Aphelion was another strong album with the Undiscovered Land making good use of what appears to be sitar. I think you had mentioned this earlier. Was it actually, or were you getting that sound off the guitar somehow?
No, it wasn't a sitar. It was a bouzouki starting the whole thing, yeah. Yeah, this was a funny process because right before, when Aphelion was near to be recorded, I still didn't have the opening track, The Undiscovered Land, and then I made a journey to Greece, to the island of Rhodes, and there I bought the bouzouki, and then the inspiration for this track came, so it was a good idea to make some holidays.
At this point, you can practically hear tracks like Shine and The Grand Design Waiting in the Wings, because The Undiscovered Land is already approaching that level of scope and drama. So what, if anything, changed to affect such a, I don't know, maybe a pinpointing and focus between Arcana and Aphelion?
Well, as I said before, Aphelion just had, I think, about a year to write the whole album, which is not very much in time, and therefore maybe I wanted to bring everything what we started on Arcana to the top, so making it maybe a bit more technical. I would say Aphelion is a much more technical album than Arcana, with a lot of crazy guitar stuff in it. And so everything what we started on Arcana is, I think, being brought to the top on Aphelion. And I think after Aphelion, it was necessary to make something different, because I didn't want to make an album, a third album, that it's maybe some kind in a row.
Right.
So I think things have changed a bit, of course, on Aphelion, like Red Ball in Blue Sky is a real crazy song with all its different rhythmical structures and harmony changes and everything. So, but still, I would say the kind of double bass songs, what we had on Aphelion, of course, we also had on Arcana, and after this album, it was really the point to stop that.
Right. And again, the relative aggression appeared to have ramped up a tad with tracks like Skyward, Perennial Dreams, and Fly at Higher Game, edging even more towards a more standard metal riffing and sound without compromising the overall approach any. One thing that I noticed when listening to the back catalog, and this came in particular focus during Fly at Higher Game, is how much of a neoclassical, almost an Yngwie Malmsteen feel there is to your bass song structure, though obviously you take things in some very different directions than he would. You know, I'm sure he wouldn't dare cycle through half as many keys per song as he tend to. Your harmonic structure is quite busy throughout, never mind all the two-hand work you lean towards. But are you hearing this? I mean, do you realize, are you coming from that basic background, like a neoclassical?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, neoclassical thing was more a part of my very beginnings, I would say, when I learned guitar, of course. I mean, Yngwie Malmsteen is a player that you have to come through when you're starting guitar. And I think Yngwie is a great guitar player and also a great songwriter. I mean, I have to admit that his real last good album was Magnum Opus, which is also dating back to 95, I think. But everything till 95 was really great that he wrote in terms of songwriting. Yeah, I mean, a point was surely that this kind of double bass thing we did till the Aphelion album always blended very well with some kind of harpsichord backings from the keyboards. So where you can bring in more melodic stuff, more arpeggiated things and things like that. So maybe this is a bit is reminding you of this neoclassical thing. Of course, also Yngwie Malmsteen had this in his songs in the beginning.
Right. And the piano that opens, as far as eyes can see, sounds a dash Beethoven, while the harpsichord on Far Point Anywhere seems quite Bach. So this brings up another question related to this. What composers do you feel influenced your sound? Because there's a definite undercurrent of the Romantic period to the indie French sound.
Definitely. I mean, Frédéric Chopin was one of my favorite composers when I played piano, and I played a lot of stuff of him. Of course, I mean, he's the master of piano literature, I would say. definitely. So he was always a big influence of mine. And one of my absolute favorite composer is Anton Bruckner, an Austrian composer of the late 19th century.
Right.
And of course, I love Antonin Dvorak. I love Richard Strauss and guys like those. So the Romantic period is definitely the most important period, I would say, in classical music.
I actually hesitated at mentioning Chopin, but I did hear it in your sound, so it's there. Another track I like a lot is The Whispering Gallery, which has a very AOR metal vibe to it and a dual track solo and counterpoint. So why was this one left as a bonus track rather than part of the album proper?
Well, I have to admit, this is one of my least favorite tracks. So,
really?
I listened back to it again, and I couldn't really find any words for the liner notes. So, I mean, it has some quite nice parts in it, but I think it was, in my opinion, it deserved to be a bonus track.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, I hear the counterpoint in that solo. I'm like, but this is really nice. Why wasn't it on there? But okay.
Yeah, I mean, I quite like this B chorus thing when this, I can't remember the lyrics at the moment to get it.
Also pulled in DC Cooper of Royal Hunt and Silent Force to sing with Sabina on Red Ball and Blue Sky, like you mentioned earlier. So how did that one come about? Did it have anything to do with their working together on the Mesa Mercuria project?
Also. I mean, Sabina and I have always been huge fans of DC's voice, and of course we love the Royal Hunt stuff with him.
Right.
Which doesn't mean that I also love the John West stuff with Royal Hunt, of course.
Right.
But DC is an absolutely phenomenal singer. And we met back at the Mesa Mercuria recordings, of course, and had some great fun with him. And at the time we recorded the Philion, he was in Germany, so it was near to ask him if he wants to come to the studio and join us. And he did a phenomenal job on this song. And I think this really brought the song to a different edge, of course.
Yeah. Next, we come to the two albums that for many fans pretty much define Edenbridge, Shine and The Grand Design. I mean, the title track of Shine is certainly up there in my top 10 songs from the band. I noticed that the production improved dramatically at this point with a much larger range and sweep. It just sounds a lot bigger and more powerful. The vocal choirs are far more lush. So what was happening here?
The basic thing that I made a break after the songwriting, we did the Aphelion tour, and then we ended the tour, I think, in May 2003. And then I really wanted to make a break, not thinking of songwriting. And the good thing is, when you decide to make a break, the ideas come from themselves. And I just collected them loosely, wrote them down, and then piled them up. And after a certain point, I was inspired again. I went through my synth libraries. I bought a new synth with a Korg Triton Extreme, which gave some great new inspiration. And also my other sound libraries. And simply I was inspired to head off to new frontiers, simply. And the one thing I said before, I really wanted to end up with those all the way through double bass songs, of course, which are not present anymore on the Shine album. And so really a lot of new stuff came. I mean, one of my favorite songs of that album and still of my all-time faves is And the Road Goes On, which is a very good song, I think. And also Canterville Ghost is something very unique, I would say, that things that happen that purely come out of new inspiration. And of course, Shine was developing to one of our all-time classics, of course, and is still in the live set in the shorter version, in the single version. And yeah, it was a great new time. And then, of course, we wanted to change something. We wanted to integrate some backing vocals, and Dennis did this beautifully, Dennis Ward.
Right.
And I think this, yeah, it brought a lot of new things into our sound.
The Scissor makes a reappearance from Move Along here, and then we have October Sky, which is the other real standout track on the album. The riff has a feel of like Jakey Lee era Ozzy to it, yet you're obviously taking things to a very different place.
Mm-hmm.
That said, I get the impression that the album tended to be, I don't know, a little more softer than we were used to, perhaps a little bit more adult contemporary, if not commercial, than the three albums that preceded it. And there was a more acoustic instrument vibe. Was this a deliberate musical choice to broaden the palette a bit?
No, it was everything come out by itself. I never make plans
right.
in advance of an album. I let the music flow, and if the music's flowing, then it leads you somewhere. If
right.
it's not flowing, then nothing brilliant comes out. And you always have to wait for the right mood, and then you're inspired, and inspiration always creates great music.
You also made an interesting choice around this time to cover the Sheena Easton James Bond theme for Your Eyes Only, though it never did make it to an album per se. And I find the Edenbridge version more lush and more bombastic than the original, not least due to the superior vocal skills Sabina brings to the table. So what motivated this one?
Well, I was always a big James Bond fan, and I especially love the movies with Roger Moore. And I have this sample where all the famous James Bond title tracks are on. And then I listened through the sample, and I somehow got stuck with For Your Eyes Only. And I thought, yeah, this could be a great idea to record this song, because this was the one and only cover version we ever did. And if we do a cover version, it has to stand near at the original, of course, but it also has to be, it has to sound like an Edenbridge song somehow. And I think in this case, we transposed the song to one half step up, because the original is in G and our version is in A flat.
Right.
And this also brought a different feel to the whole song. And yeah, I think it was a nice experiment.
And I also noticed that Sabina is stylizing the song a bit, where, that's not in the original, obviously. And now we come to my personal favorite Edenbridge album, The Grand Design, particularly in its unedited form. The title track is truly epic, and the extended solo section is particularly interesting, with that sort of Italian mandolin section that turns into a more Japanese modality. And then when it returns, it comes into this laid-back, Al Di Meola-style Spanish guitar fantasia. So what were you thinking with this one?
Well, as the Grand Design is basically about the great, how should I say it, the grand design of our Earth, I wanted to bring in different musical cultures and bind them together with this huge choir part. And so one part came to the other. First, it starts out with this Mediterranean thing with the bouzouki and the sas.
Right.
And then this Spanish guitar thing, what our, at that time, player Martin Meyer played. And then, I think before was the Japanese thing with the pipa,
right.
I integrated and the koto. And so I think that was a great idea to bring in this different musical structures. And I think this also showing the diversity of our sound.
Very much so. It really stands out to this day. Flame of Passion is another real standout. But what I consider to be the greatest of all Edenbridge songs, and the one I play to people who have never heard you before, is Evermore. It's like you distilled everything about the band into this one concise, catchy 4-minute track.
Well, I have to say Evermore is some kind of a blueprint for quite similar songs maybe that followed afterwards, like Remember Me and then our two video hits, Higher and The Light on You Tomorrow.
Right.
So Evermore was, this was also some kind of experiment. I wanted to bring in those crunchy rhythm guitars where you don't have any palm muting, but where the chords are played through in fourth or eighth notes. And I think this added a lot of bombastic feel to those kind of songs. So this was also some kind of new experiment, which we started and then continued on our follow-ups.
And even though it sounds like a normal metal song, you've got these wide-open altered chords that you're using. To me, listening to this coming from a musical background, I was like, wow, you know, how did you distill all of this into this tight? It's almost like you took all the filler out, and there you go. Just 4 minutes, listen to it, it's done. You get the idea of what this band is.
Yeah, you have to be careful. I mean, therefore we changed the guitar sound a bit on the Grand Design to some lush, lighter sound and not this heavy sound. So I also used different guitars on that album because there are a lot of 7 chords, and we also played those -7 chords and this also the 7-9 flat 5 chords
right.
Also in the rhythm guitars, and therefore it adds a lot of feel to the whole part.
And that's what I was hearing. That's what fascinated me, the fact that you're using these altered chords. And it sounds like it's regular chords, but it's not.
It's not, it's not.
I did
but
notice.
But we didn't use it in all 4 rhythm guitar parts, only in 2, because in all 4 it would have been too much.
Right.
So two are pretty much standard, and the 2 others we integrated those chords.
I did notice a nod to your Bond cover again in Terra Nova, where you play around with the John Barry theme a bit. Between this and For Your Eyes Only, were you in the running to actually do a Bond theme or something? Or was it just, you know, you're a fan and you wanted to put it in there?
Well, do you mean the small part in Terra Nova?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, it was simply there. I mean, I think it was we needed some kind of break part in between those verses, and as we already had this James Bond cover version, that brought me to the Bond theme, and it simply appeared, and I put it in because Terra Nova was the last track I wrote for the Grand Design album. It was finished a few days before we started the album recordings, which was pretty hard work. It was 3 weeks before the recordings, we didn't have an opening track, and in 3 weeks, Terra Nova was written, and it was some of the heaviest songwriting processes I can ever imagine. So this was pretty hard.
Right around this time, a sort of greatest hits album comes out with the Chronicles of Eden. I know this was pretty heavy with tracks off of both Shine and The Grand Design, but all five albums are reasonably well represented, plus a few singles like For Your Eyes Only and some unreleased bonus and instrumental tracks. So which was the genesis of this one?
Well, we owed our record company, Massacre Records, still three more extra songs. And then we decided to make a compilation, but we didn't want to make some half-hearted compilation, but to make really something special. And the fact that we always had bonus tracks, of course, on the various singles and various albums, it was near to make a CD1, to integrate all those bonus tracks on CD1. And then we asked the fans to name their favorite songs for the best of. And the funny thing was that most of our epic tracks showed up. And so we said, okay, if this is the choice of the fans, we do it like this. And I think it was a nice product, and it sold really well for a compilation album. Therefore, we were quite happy to do that.
One track that really stands out to me here is Thin Red Line, which I believe is recorded for Aphelion, but never made the album for some reason. So why was that?
Well, actually, it was written for the Arcana. Same thing with The Silent Wake. And both tracks did not fit on the Arcana album. I mean, if you listen to the songs, I think you would agree. And so they stayed in the drawer. And it was a good idea then to take it out, because anyway, we needed three extra tracks for the Chronicles of Eden compilation. And I think that was the right place for them. And I think, yeah, Thin Red Line is a funny thing is that Thin Red Line we played on our very first show ever back in 2000. Yeah. So this was I think we only played it on two or three concerts. And yeah, nice song.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema with our special guest tonight, Ron Ball from Eden Bridge. In our next segment, we'll be talking spirituality, My Earth Dream, and solitaire, and touching the personal tragedy that led to the bombing, only here on Third Eye Cinema.
Primal Fear and Rock Meets Classic, and you guys are listening to Third Eye Cinema. Wow.
You may have to grab most of them in there.
All right.
Hi, folks. This is IQ Freeze from Dark Age, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema. We are really happy to be on the show, so check out our stuff. See you soon.
Okay. Hi there. This is George and Thomas from Serenity. And you're listening to Third Eye Cinema Show together with Team.
That's right.
Should we do it one more time? Okay. So, hi there. This is Georg and Thomas from Serenity, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Hey there. This is Marcos from Uproots, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema. Enjoy it.
Hey, this is Homer Simpson. Why don't you do yourself a favor and check out the new Eden Spirits album? It's called Symphony of Sin. I love it, especially when they give away free donuts.
I'll do your normal one if you want.
Sure, go ahead.
Hi, this is Paul Logue from the band Eden's Curse, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema. Keep rocking. Stay cursed.
And in our next segment, we'll be talking spirituality, My Earth Dream and Solitaire, and touch on the personal tragedy that led to the bonding only here on Third Eye Cinema. But first up, continuing our progress of the Eden Bridge history, this is one off Aphelion, where we journey to the undiscovered land.
Yeah.
So you moved to Napalm from My Earth Dream, which was the first album to feature just yourself on guitars, and I believe it was also your first to feature a large orchestra, which you provided the score for. And yet, at the same time, you started leaning towards a more crunchy, detuned seven-string guitar sound to hear throughout the album. Just for example, on a track like Shadow Player Paramount, there's a little bit less of the soaring, optimistic feel of the earlier material. Things appear to have turned a sight darker. This is all alternated with tracks that are almost entirely orchestral or featuring Sabina accompanied by orchestra alone, like Whale Rider and The Force Within. It was dramatically different to the one that fans were expecting from albums previous. So what was going on behind the scenes to inspire such a pronounced stylistic change?
Well, it was also a complete natural process. The fact that the new deal with Napalm gave us the opportunity to work with a real orchestra, and I knew this before. And therefore, I had to change something in our guitar tuning, because on the standard tuning, together with an orchestra, you cannot bring out the guitars, and also you cannot bring out the orchestra. It's strings and standard tuning guitars is always something different to bring together. So I wanted to change something in the guitar sound, and therefore it was pretty clear to change to seven-string guitars and also tune it down a half step. So we tuned it down to B-flat from the normal B tuning.
Right.
And yeah, this gave room for everything, I would say, because you can bring out the guitars on the one hand, and you can bring out the orchestra, which was very important, of course. And it's interesting to say a song like Whale Rider was dating back to the late 90s when I wrote this song, and I always knew we have to record this song with a real orchestra. So, and I knew sometimes there will be the opportunity to work together with a real orchestra, and therefore it was pretty clear to take it out of the drawer for the Maya String album and then to record it with the orchestra. And this was, I think, also a very nice song, which had the right forum then with a real orchestra, of course.
But the album, based on what came before and what would come after, it had a feel of being somewhat of a transitional album, you know, between the image of the first five albums and the album to come.
It happened. It was the kind of new things that inspired me, all the orchestral stuff, of course, and everything that came. And we also wanted to go in a bit of a heavier direction after the Grand Design album.
Right.
Definitely. I wanted to make the music a bit heavier. And so everything came on naturally.
Next, we come to Solitaire, which crosses the My Earth Dream sound with something approaching early epica, you know, Entree and Exit Unique in particular with those huge choral sections. I thought it was a more integrated approach, though it was a bit more mainstream and in tune with what other gothic symphonic metal bands were doing at the time in the overall sound. Were you doing a lot of touring with bands like, say, Within Temptation, Nemesis, or Hunsun that pulled you in this more, not necessarily commercial, but a more concise and detuned guitar-driven short-form direction?
Not really. I not try to get inspired by bands of a similar style. I also have to admit that I don't like too many bands of this female fronted, of course. Within Temptation is a great band, and I really love the Unforgiven album they did in 2011, which is, I think, one of the best pop metal albums ever. I think Solitaire is consisting of really great songs. I also was facing that now because we're playing a lot of the songs live for our upcoming tour. Also, natural process, trying to get inspired by things that are moving you, and then follow your heart and follow the music.
Right. And though it was very different from what had come before, there were some really strong tracks to be found in here, like Higher, Virtual Dream, and particular Come Undone, which should have been a huge radio hit with that chorus.
Yeah. Come Undone is also a great song to play live. Yeah, most of those songs are really catchy. I also have to say I love Brothers on Diamir, which is really touching and really bombastic and epic song. And on the other hand, we have an Irish song we didn't have before, like Skyline's End, which is also bringing in something completely different.
A Virtual Dream was especially odd for Edenbridge, coming off more like a 90s-era Testament track whenever Sabina's not singing. You know, it was like modern thrash with that surprisingly aggressive riff and the hyperactive double bass. So where did that one come from?
Well, Virtual Dream, I would say the whole lyrics are dealing with this kind of machinery and this kind of topic. So I wanted to bring some strange keyboard technical machine-like sounds in, and of course, I was a great fan of thrash metal in the 80s, and Testament was one of my favorite thrash bands back in the 80s with albums like The Legacy and The New Order, of course, and so I always liked this kind of thrash riffing, but it also came naturally. It's not that I planned it, and this is the great thing I have to come back to when it comes to the Edenbridge sound. If I like to integrate a thrash riff, I do it. And if I like to integrate, I don't know, a choir, or if I like to integrate a foreign-sounding instrument, I simply do it. I don't make up my mind, because Edenbridge is a forum. You can bring in nearly everything, as long as it sounds like Edenbridge in the end.
So
and this is pure musical freedom.
Last year, you made the move to SPV Steamhammer for the bonding, and I understand that this one followed on some personal issues affecting both you and Sabina. What was the story behind this album?
Well, the interesting thing is that I knew pretty much from, I don't know, even when I wrote the first songs for the album, I knew that this next album has to be called The Bonding. Of course, I didn't knew the higher connections, why this album should be called The Bonding. I simply knew it. I had it somehow in me. Right. And then all these tragic incidents are happening with the suicide of my father in 2011. And therefore, this whole thing then reflected on most of the lyrics on the album, which I all wrote after the death of my father.
Right.
Very, very much of the inspiration came. And although most of the musical side was already written, but of course all the lyrical thing, like song Star-Crossed Dreamer, the song Into a Sea of Souls, the song Shadows of My Memory, so those were all heavily inspired, of course, by those incidents.
Yeah, I mean, this is obviously something extremely heavy to deal with or even touch on. So, first off, kudos to you for even doing this. And secondly, I'm surprised that it seemed to pull someone more into a power metal direction as opposed to going straight into gothic metal or something like that you would expect with these kind of things hanging over your head.
Well, I think Edenbridge was never a band that can be called gothic metal. I mean, of course, we have a lot of gothic metal fans and have some songs that are going maybe in a bit in this direction, but Inbridge was always very open, and I always considered the band to be a real symphonic metal band, symphonic in the sense that we're using real orchestras and using the real fundament of the world of symphony. Well, power metal is an interesting aspect. Of course, there are some songs that can be named in this direction, like Shadows of My Memory, also the opening track, Mystic River, of course, with its riffing. But an interesting fact was that I started something new on this album because I wrote parallelly on all songs. So I collected a lot of ideas and then started to arrange the first ones, and then 10 songs opened up. And when I got stuck on the one song, I continued with another one. So all of them were written and arranged parallelly, which was something new and a very interesting process.
The album itself, musically speaking, appears to be split between the hyper-aggressiveness that marked much of Solitaire and a more acoustic piano-based approach that may have led you to your more recent side project, Boisiano. So tell us a bit about that.
Well, of course, a lot of balladesque songs opened up on the Bonding album, like Star-Crossed Dreamer, Death Is Not the End,
right.
And of course, Far Out of Reach, which is also some kind of new stuff we did on this album. Actually, I have to say, I wouldn't say that the Bonding album opened up this new project, Voiciano. It was more the fact that we were invited to play an acoustic 10-minute show in Vietnam in the year 2000. Where only Sabine and I played. I played the piano, grand piano on stage, and she sang. And we played 3 tracks in Vietnam. It was an acoustic version of Higher. We played Elsewhere from the Shine album, and we played The Most Beautiful Place from the Grand Design album. And this was so much fun, I have to say. It was pure fun because we could rehearse in our living room and then simply fly to Vietnam, and then we didn't have to care about some equipment and everything, just enter the stage and play. And when I returned, I went through all my files and my musical ideas, which couldn't be used on the last albums. And I found so many great layouts of songs that were, from the beginning, maybe written on for such a project. And this inspired me. I worked out these ideas, and then I was inspired to write completely new songs for Voiciano. And it was so much fun because everything is so different. Everything is purely played live. I recorded most of all the pianos live. And then I went to the studio and record guitars, and it was somehow so much of the things were recorded freely without click tracks and everything. And there is so much life in those songs because everything is so free, and it was a great process.
Yeah, I actually find everybody's insistence on using click tracks to be kind of counterproductive musically, because I understand why they do it, because they don't want to come off, oh, look, they're off meter, and have, especially nowadays with these kids, they're very anal about, oh, look, he was half a beat off or something. But,
yeah, well,
you know, music is organic. It's supposed to come from your gut and your soul, and therefore, you know, that's part of what you're infusing into it.
Of course, but you must not forget that on an Edenbridge production, you have 200 tracks.
True.
it's standard, and without click tracks, you're lost. Of course, I mean, you have to have some tightness, of course,
right.
Because if you have to sync drums with guitars and then 32 tracks of orchestra, I mean, you don't add it to the point, of course, and then there is still a lot of life in the music. But if you start a new project and then reduce it very much, right. And often it's just piano and voice, and you would be stupid to play this on a click track, because this has to live from the live feel, of course, and you don't need to use click tracks. This is a great thing, and then playing every instrument to the pre-recorded piano is also some kind of new experiment.
Right, yeah, no, you're right, because if you've got that many tracks playing into it in an orchestra,
yeah.
Then yeah.
Definitely. It wouldn't work without relying on a fixed click, of course. Yeah.
So just recently, as I mentioned at the outset, you just re-released the entire Masca era catalog, remastered in these double disc digipacks with new liner notes, both through your fan club and via Steamhammer. Interestingly, you included both the new remaster and the original album mix on Sunrise in Eden, while the others seem to be a bit more of like a mixed bag where you've got instrumental versions on Arcana, you've got the Live Time in Eden album, minus the DVD, with Aphelion, and a mix of live and instrumental versions with both the Shine and Grand Design. So tell us about all this. What was behind the two mixes of Sunrise, for example?
Well, the first mix was done by our friend Gandalf, a very famous, worldwide known musician, and we actually recorded the album in his studio. And then also he did the mix, and we did a mastering, and this was the version we sent out to the record labels back in 1999. As we didn't have any bonus tracks for the Sunrise in Eden album, because all the songs we recorded came on the album,
right.
It was a good idea to present the fans the original mix, because it sounded a bit different. Maybe it's not that powerful like the mix Dennis did afterwards, but I think nevertheless it was interesting to integrate this mix, which was somehow the original version of the album, to this package.
And with the other ones, for the most part, you've got a lot of instrumental tracks. It's almost like a karaoke version. So what were you thinking with those?
Well, as we integrated both bonus tracks on the Arcana album on the disc one, I had the complete instrumental mix. And it's always nice for what we faced with the fans, for people who, some singers by themselves and then
right.
Sing the songs. So with these instrumental versions, they have the possibility now. And of course, in Asia, it's still karaoke is something popular.
Oh, yeah.
And therefore, maybe it's opening up a bit of a market, and maybe some karaoke bars can use the songs whatsoever. I think it's a nice bonus for the fans.
This next one applies more to the first five albums than the last three, but even so, there's a certain, and it's kind of hard to express this, so bear with me, but there's an almost healing approach to the positivity and the major key sweetness to the early Eden Bridge material that you just remastered and re-released, but without ever getting overly cloying or pop radio and feel. It's like it's soft without weakness, melodic, while still being something of somewhere a musician can pay close attention to it and walk away satisfied. I know more than once I find myself pulling out Eden Bridge when I have a really negative, stress-filled day, and then I'll walk away feeling a lot better, and, you know, it's healthier in a sense. So where does or did this sentiment and driving force originate from? Are you particularly religious or mystical? Because it feels very much akin to that. You know, there's a core genuineness about the ethereality of your music that would be pretty much impossible to fake if somebody wanted to.
Well, I have to say I'm not religious in this kind of sense, but Sabine and I are both interested in, and I think we're both living some spirituality. This is, I think,
yeah.
This is what it is behind their music, and this is the point you can feel. I mean, if you do such a kind of music, of course the lyrics are also important. You cannot do this kind of music with some nonsense lyrics. And everything is painting a picture, and I think this was very important from the beginning on, and I think these positive vibes, when the music is positive, you also have to come up with some positive sounding lyrics, and not in the kind of happy things, but in some kind of spiritual positive spiritual background.
How do you feel being an Austrian act influences you and sets you apart as distinct from the more typically German base for so many metal bands, particularly once you start getting into areas that you sort of orbit around, like the power metal and the gothic metal arenas?
Well, I don't think that Austria, I mean, Austria is, of course, different to Germany, especially to North Germany, because we have a different dialect. And I think Austrians are have much more humor than people from Germany. yeah, it is. It is like that. But nevertheless, I would say it is not that maybe the country is reflecting too much. Inbridge was always a very international band when it comes to this kind of thing. And I've never made up my mind when it comes to, okay, we're from Austria, we have to bring in this or bring in that. So I think the country
doesn't have too much influence, I would say, on our music, especially because Austrian bands had it quite hard in maybe 20 years ago to get themselves established in the international market. And I think we were one of the first bands that opened up a lot for other bands here in our country.
Yeah, and you were kind of going where I was thinking, where in terms of, you know, you're saying about the Austrian mindset being have a better sense of humor, even a band that's completely unrelated to you, like Contrast, you've got this, you know, there's something that's separating you in the mindset.
I don't think that it's the fact that we come from Austria. It's more my musical background, I would say. I'm very open-minded to various kinds of music. I grew up with classical music. I love prog rock. I love AOR. I love artists like Vangelis or Mike Oldfield. I love metal, of course. So it's this very, very wide musical field, which is my inspiration of influence. And I think this is reflecting on the music. When you're only listening to power metal, then power metal is coming out around music. But when you very diversified in your musical taste, I think this is reflecting in the music, and then you can juggle with different musical aspects and different musical styles.
So this one's going to be a bit closer to home. As I believe you and Sabina are involved, do you find the recording and touring to bring you guys closer together, or is it more of a challenge to building and maintaining a relationship over all these years?
Well, both. I mean, on the one hand, it's of course a great thing to make music with your partner, and we've been together for many years now. So of course we know each other very well. On the other hand, of course, there can be fields of friction.
Right.
Because when you're together, of course, everything is mixing up the personal thing and also the musical thing, and therefore you have to be very careful, of course, to not overdo certain things, but the advantages are outweighing the disadvantages, of course.
And here's an even tougher one. Do you find yourself disillusioned at all after so many years in the industry to see what's become something of, I guess, a glass ceiling for full-time musicians in a world where we've got these, like, no-talent rappers and Disney kids, especially over here in these states, that appear to be the only ones getting all this attention and money, whereas bands that are actually musicians are just kind of making do at best?
Well, I have to say, I don't think in those terms. I mean, I'm happy to be able to make a living out of the music for nearly 15 years now, which is phenomenal, pretty much from the start of the band. And I'm happy to be able to do the music and can make a living out of it. Of course, it's connected to the fact that I'm the only songwriter and I'm doing all the management and all the organizational stuff.
Right.
But it was my dream, always my dream to make music and to be able to make a living. So I think you always have to face the market and how it's gonna change.
Yeah.
And we always have to feel and see those changes. And then you have to adapt certain things in your field and in your surrounding. And I think this is the important thing.
Yeah, because for a lot of people that I've talked to, it's almost like we've all become jazz musicians, just doing it for the love of the craft and either holding down another full-time job or pretty much starving for our art. So, final question here. In a world as dark as the one we currently inhabit and the even uglier one that we seem to be hurtling towards, do you think there's any place for a message of hope and beauty like the one that Edenbridge, particularly in terms of the earlier material, represents?
Always, and I think we still represent that, this positive thing, although our music became a bit more earthy and a bit more darker maybe.
Right.
But I think when you read the lyrics, they are still positive, that we changed to something negative. Maybe not that positive anymore like it was in the beginning, but you're changing. As I said before, you're changing as a human being. And in your 20s, you're different than in the 40s, of course. So things change. But I think that it's still important to give people hope, definitely. I mean, the world is in some paradigm shift, what we're facing a couple of years. And this whole, the whole world is, you can feel that many things are changing.
Yeah.
I see it in the personal surrounding and you can see it in the news every day. And so it's still more important, I think, that people are relying on the things, everyone should rely on the things that he or she is really good in. I think when we all going back to the things, of course, it's not always easy. But if you go back to the things what you really love to do. Mm-hmm. And more people go back to this thing, I think the whole world also becomes a better place because sure. You're filling your heart with the things that you really want to do.
Yeah, that's very true.
And I think we will face this even more in the coming years because people can't stand it anymore.
Yeah.
To do things and to break in things that don't fill up your life.
Yeah, very true. So any upcoming tour plans that you want to mention?
Yeah, we're starting our UK tour next week, starting on the 11th with 5 shows in Britain and then doing some shows in Austria and Switzerland. And this week we could confirm the first summer festivals in Czech Republic in summer. So I really hope that more shows will add to our tour plan. And yeah, we have to see, but it's great to be back after 4.5 years on
right.
the stage. It was really a long time being absent from stage, but many things, as I said, in our lives changed
yeah.
in the past year, so there wouldn't be any way to being able to go on stage, but it's great to be back, of course.
So do you have anything you'd like to plug, or did you want to point listeners to your website or your Facebook page?
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, check our homepage, edenbridge.org, or go to our Facebook page, what you also find on our homepage, the link. And, of course, join in to our new crowdfunding campaign, to our new project, Voiciano,
right.
which will be out in spring because we started the crowdfunding campaign at the end of January. The reaction is really great so far. So all our diehard fans, most of them are already joined in. but America is a bit lazy yet. So I hope that all our American fans who are always supporting us in a great way, also on the orchestra crowdfunding on the last album, I hope they are also joining in on the crowdfunding for Voiciano.
Well, with that, Lanvois, I'd like to thank you again for joining us here on Third Eye Cinema, and we'd love to have you back to talk your next album.
Thanks a lot. This was a great interview because it was different, speaking about each and every album, and it was great speaking to somebody that really got into the music and really got into the song. So I really appreciate that. Thanks a lot.
And
a great
Tschüss, and hope to talk to you again soon.
Yeah, tschüss, and speak again next time.
And to close out our interview with Lanvois, this is my all-time favorite Edenbridge track, which shows the band at their most concisely representative as well. Stay tuned for one last Edenbridge classic after the close, but right now, hailing from the Grand Design, this is Evermore. Thanks for joining us tonight. We hope you enjoy our interview with Juan Ball. Next time on Third Eye Cinema, the lovely Reeve Christine returns to talk Reeve's Eyes. If you'd like to talk, contact us here. Comments, suggestions, or you're a filmmaker, musician, like to join us on air, email us at thirdeyecinema@hotmail.com. Visit our website, thirdeyecinema.wordpress.com, or our Facebook page, facebook.com/thirdeyecinema. Third Eye Cinema brought to you by the Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio. Here's one more from Ian Bridge, which kind of says it all, because we're all part of the grand design.
Thank you.
missed any part of this or any other Third Eye Cinema broadcast, just visit our website or Facebook page for links to the shows in question. All Blog Talk Radio shows are available for archive listener download at your convenience. And next week...
Okay. Hi, everybody. This is me, Christine, from Leave Size, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema. Rock on!
And after that...
Okay, hello, this is Trollman from Trollfest, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema. Keep it real, people.
And after that...
Okay. Hi, everybody, this is Chris Pachanka. Hi, everybody, this is Chris Pachanka from Vanishing Point, all the way in Australia. You listen to Third Eye Cinema. Check it out. Crank it up.
And after that...
This is Dave Gaughan from the Canadian folk power metal band Scythia, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
And later in May.
Name of the show is Third Eye Media, right?
Oh, Third Eye Cinema.
Cinema, okay. It says media here on my schedule. Okay, so Third Eye Cinema. So, hey, everybody, this is Pete Zug of Iron Savior, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema. Have fun and enjoy the ride.
Nice. Stay tuned.